All right, we are now embarking on lecture 21. The state and accumulation. The arguments around what makes the capitalist state a capitalist state, the negative selection argument that we've been exploring, all point in the direction of what can be thought of as a functionalist account of the state. That is, just to remind you, a functionalist account of the state would say the state takes the form it does because this is necessary in order for it to fulfill certain functions. So the answer to the question, why does the state have a tax form as the way of acquiring resources? The answer is because this is necessary for reproducing capitalism. The claim that the tax form, taxation as the way of acquiring resources, has a capitalist character is in the first instance just a descriptive claim. That is, this has the effect of making the state dependent on accumulation. That's just the empirical claim. But the explanatory argument then is, and this explains why the state has that character. The capitalist state has these class characteristics because they're functional for capitalism. That makes it a functionalist explanation, not just a functional description. And this is a kind of standard way that Marxian theorists, in one way or another, think about the capitalist state. It's not just a description that the capitalist state has these capitalism-reproducing effects, but this is also meant to be explanatory for why the state is the way it is. Now, it's not meant to be a complete explanation. Why the state is the way it is also has to do with the history of class struggle, the victories and defeats, the particular historical moments when institutions get built and designed in particular ways. But at the end of the day, when you get rid of all the complexities and all the historical details, it still has this strongly functionalist character to it, that you're explaining the form of the state by virtue of the forms the functions that that form fulfills. And that's why this way of thinking about the state does fit into this broadly based superstructure way of thinking about it. Now, there's a weak and a strong version of this argument. The strong version is, well, let me say the weak version first. The weak version is that the capitalist form leads to exclusions with the class content. That is, it creates obstacles to policies which would be disruptive to capitalism. But there's no implication that among the included policies, the ones that are best for capitalism are the ones that are chosen. It's just a claim that what's excluded are the highly disruptive policies, but what's included could be suboptimal. There's no optimality thesis. The strong version says among the non-excluded possibilities, the optimal one for capitalism is selected. So as the first just general point on the relationship between the capitalist state and accumulation that I want to make is the strong version is just wildly implausible. You know, there's such masses of evidence that it's wrong because the state frequently adopts suboptimal policies from the point of view of accumulation. It adopts suboptimal policies either because of stupidity, you know, state actors who are actually crafting these policies may be themselves mired in ideological mystifications and confusion and simply make lots of mistakes and lack a capacity to recognize that their mistakes are mistakes. So there's lots of suboptimal things that happen all the time. So just empirically, the strong version just doesn't have any plausibility. So the weak version of the functional explanation, that is, that the exclusion mechanisms are pretty good at excluding the highly disruptive and dysfunctional policies. That one at least has some strong credibility. And that when those negative exclusions begin to fail in this weaker sense, that is, highly disruptive policies enter the political domain, then the argument is that that's the moment where you have crises and the balance of forces of class power determines the outcome, not the form of the state. And in those cases, by and large, capitalist conditions of accumulation get restored and the state gets re-equilibrated around that minimalist exclusionary path because it's so hard to robustly build an alternative. And efforts to do so tend to be undermined by all sorts of contradictions which they face. So I think the first kind of punchline from what we've said so far is that the weak version is the one that has the most plausibility. Yeah.
So would the functional explanation for the capitalist state, would that be able to be extended to a theory of why states exist and why they existed in pre-capitalist societies? Or, I mean, is the state functional in all those regards as well?
Well, the state, remember what we're trying to explain is not the existence of the state, but the form of the state. So why does the feudal state take the form it does?
Okay.
It does so because it helps to reproduce feudalism.
So that is a functional?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it excludes, the feudal state takes the form it does because it excludes it excludes actions which would be highly disruptive to feudalism. But I, you know, as I said in my general comments on the theory of history, the trans-historical character of these arguments gets weaker when you move back from capitalism, and it gets vaguer when you move forward from capitalism. And I think that the weight of the theory should rest on how well does it do in understanding the world in which we live, not ancient Greece. So there are very interesting Marxian accounts of ancient Greece which emphasize the nature of slave class relations and the difference between citizens and non-citizens and how that worked to create a stable Grecian society within which philosophy could flourish. And I am not an expert on this. I find the stuff I've read on that extremely interesting. But I don't think the adequacy or inadequacy of those accounts of ancient Greece have a lot to do with the adequacy or inadequacy of understanding the contradictions of contemporary capitalism. So Marxists who study ancient Greece could be completely wrong about the functional relationships between the form of the Greek polity in Athens and the underlying class structure and conflicts, could be completely wrong about that and still have the best theory we have available for the contradictions of contemporary capitalism. So I don't think as much rides on the meta theory that would make it the same theoretical elements have the same relevance for both of these types of society. That would be important only if the only grounds for believing that this is true for capitalism, true meaning better than other alternative accounts, rests on its faithfulness to the meta theory, which is not the way I think one should approach these things. I don't think you need to have a comprehensive meta theory that works in every context before you can be confident that it works in any context, in any given context. And that's the kind of theoretical move that Marxists have often felt pressured to make because of their defensive reaction to attacks. If you're being attacked for your account of capitalism and you can make appeal to a higher order theory, which you believe is unassailable, that's a way of defending your theory of capitalism, as opposed to just defending your theory of capitalism because the evidence is just very strong that this is a better theory than the neoclassical rivals, let's say, neoliberal rivals to the understanding of the contradictions.
But doesn't Terborn rely on a meta theory by each mode of production produces a particular?
So he's I'm in the let a thousand flowers bloom perspective on theory building. I find Terborn's work enormously insightful, but I think in practice the main function of his account of feudalism is the providing the theoretical contrasts that bring into relief the operation of his mechanisms in capitalism. That's its main function. Its main function is not for experts and theorists of feudalism to suddenly say, yes, that's the right way to think about the dynamics of feudalism. It may be. You know, I'm not dismissing that. But I don't think one should think that the cogency of the argument of the tax dependency of the capitalist state on private accumulation, the cogency of that argument doesn't depend upon the adequacy of his account that feudal monarchs got their revenues from their own feudal estates, which is the contrasting mechanism for resource acquisition in feudalism. It could turn out that they actually got most of their revenues from moneylenders, and the moneylenders got their revenues from taxing, from lending money to everybody. You know, that could be the way that feudal lords actually ran their armies. And therefore, the contrast that Terborn drew was heuristic rather than historical. But that wouldn't therefore say yes, and therefore the capitalist state is not dependent on taxation for its revenues. Okay? All right. So, the weak form of the functionalist argument is the way we should go. The key problem for functionalist explanations, in general, is the problem of the feedback process. What are the actual mechanisms that make the functional explanation work? That's the key problem. Functionalist explanations are often black box explanations. They just specify vaguely that there must be some sort of feedback process that accomplishes this. Is the feedback loop closed by conscious manipulation by capitalists who design the institutions in such a way that all these exclusions occur in the right way? Is it the result of class struggle, victories and defeats of classes? Is there some inherent selection principle that works behind the backs of actors? Right, that's the neatest form of feedback, the Darwinian one. Right? So natural selection works behind the backs of actors. They don't have to know what the hell's going on, and yet you get the functional outcome. The explanation for why capitalist firms generally have organizational structures that enable them to acquire stable profits, natural selection process is not a bad one for explaining why that happens, because firms that don't have those attributes get eaten up. You know, there is a kind of Darwinian process going on in the jungle of the market. I think the explanation for functionality has to involve three kinds of elements. This would be my formula, if you will. You know, so the way of approaching this. And this way of approaching it then also helps set the stage for understanding the contradictions of functionality. The first element is an account of political class struggle. That's the process of creating the filters themselves. At certain historical moments, the institutional arrangements are themselves objects of struggle. Sometimes they're taken for granted, they just exist as parameters. Other times, they become the objects of struggle. The filtering mechanisms are in play as objects of struggle. And this results in creating class filters and these system-reproducing arrangements. That's what the struggles are about. So remember the three-level contrast I drew in the earlier discussion of politics between struggles over the game that's being played, struggles over the rules of the game, and struggles over plays in the game. There are historical moments in which what's in play in a struggle is the fundamental rules of the game, and sometimes that spills over into struggles over what game is being played. The struggles over what game to play, that is, what kind of state do we have in its basic, deep form, that's extremely rare. Struggles over the rules of the game are not so rare, but it's pretty unusual that they tap into very basic rules, but sometimes they do. Most struggles in politics are over plays in the game, where the basic institutional forms are parameters of struggle, not in play for struggle. It's arguable that that we're in a period where there are struggles that are over the rules of the game, but over pretty fundamental rules. You know, if indeed, for example, a balanced budget amendment were passed and the flat tax 999 formula, you know, if those things actually happened, that would so disable the functioning of the state with respect to how it could intervene in the economy, if those new rules were really instituted, it would create a whole new variant of the capitalist state. It wouldn't just be a tweaking of rules within the same parameters. It's one of the reasons why those things aren't going to happen, because I think it would be so dysfunctional for capitalism that there would be just too many points in which it would get blocked by powerful forces that would come to realize how stupid these things were. Okay, so struggles, political class struggles, are one of the ingredients to provide for this feedback process by which institutions get created. Secondly, you need an account of the systemic pressures which make certain solutions stable and others precarious. So out of the political class struggles, you're going to get institutional designs, changes in rules. Some of these stick and some of these unravel. Whether they stick or unravel is not up to the actors. Whether they stick or unravel depends upon what their ramifications are. We can capture that by saying there are systemic pressures that get set in motion by institutional solutions, changes in the rules, which make some solutions stable and others precarious. And finally, you need some kind of process of institutional learning. You need some kind of way in which there's trial and error corrections to failures which occur. Often nobody knows what will work. You know, people posture, political forces say a balanced budget will work. They will propose solutions to problems. They will win the day in the sense of being able to mobilize sufficient political forces to put their proposals into practice. If they're wrong, if what they propose makes things even worse, then the system needs to have some learning capacity to correct those mistakes. That's one of the reasons why bourgeois democracy has been as stable as it is, because it allows for the correction of mistakes when actions are palpably wrong, dysfunctional. The problem with the institutional design of bourgeois democracy itself is that it can contribute to mistakes, not just provide a mechanism for correcting them. If you get a sufficiently long period of trial and error mistakes and the corrections being new mistakes, so you get kind of endless cycles of failures, then the level of stability of the basic rules of the game is likely to be called into question, particularly if this occurs in the context of endless blocking coalitions, so that the way in which system change occurs is by vetoes. Repeated vetoes. This can actually lead to fundamental institutional crisis. This is one of the descriptions for what happened in the Weimar Republic, for example. That the problem in the Weimar Republic was not a conspiracy of elites to overthrow democracy in favor of fascism. It was a complete incapacity of elites to resolve problems. Continual blocking coalitions that prevented any action, so that you had perpetual failure, which then just eroded the mass base of support for any kind of constitutional solution, and that created the opening for fascism. Okay, I now want to turn to this problem of, or how we should understand the nature of the, if you will, the failures of functionality. So rather than take as our point of departure what might be called the bourgeois political utopia, right? So the bourgeois, the capitalist utopia, is a fantasy that institutions could be designed in such a way that they would effectively reproduce capitalism without any necessity for political intervention by capitalists. This would be the bourgeois utopia, right? You'd have these beautifully designed political institutions that automatically and perfectly reproduce the conditions for accumulation and always coming up with the right solution. The libertarian fantasy is like that. They believe if only we could get government out of the way and just let markets do the job, then they would always come up with the optimal solutions to whatever problems the system encountered. The problem is that there are many different ways in which, no matter how you design institutions, they will produce contradictory functionality, not homeostatic functionality. Homeostatic functionality is the way thermostats work in a room, right? So whenever the temperature gets too hot, the thermostat kicks off the furnace. Whenever it gets too cold, it automatically kicks in the furnace, so you get a stable temperature in the room. That's the beauty of a homeostatic system. That's not the way actual institutions work. There are four types of contradictory functionality which theorists have identified. There may be others. These are at least the four that I've distilled from my readings of the literature. I refer to this broadly as the problem of contested and contradictory functionality. So here's, just to step back for a second, here's the kind of big picture way that I think about these things. On the one hand, I endorse the central intuition of the weak functionality thesis. So the weak functionality system is, this is not an anything goes system. We don't live in a world where it's kind of random and that it's just the way it is because it's the way it is. No. We live in the world that we do because institutions have sufficiently functional designs that they more or less reproduce the system by excluding the worst and most dysfunctional outcomes. And there are feedback processes which tend to correct this over time when the mistakes occur. That's this weak functionality argument. And that looking at these class biases is a way of diagnosing how that works. That's part of the argument. But on the other hand, I want to say this is always contested and contradictory. It's not smooth functioning functionality. And therefore, it's not just crisis prone in a kind of vague way. There are very specific reasons why the system both works and doesn't work continuously. So this isn't just an episodic problem of crisis. It's a continual tension inside of this functional relationship. It's so, the slogan or the term to use is contested and contradictory functionality. That's at least the way I like to label it. There are four types of contested and contradictory functionality. The first, I'll just label these and then we'll begin our discussion of them. The first is the contradiction between legitimation and accumulation. This can be thought of as contradictions between different functions of the state. The second is the contradiction between autonomy and subordination of the state. This is contradictions within a particular function, within the accumulation process. So the first is a contradiction between two different functions. This is a contradiction within a given function. The third are a series of contradictions in the administrative rationality of the state. That is, how the state administratively functions contradicts what it has to accomplish. And the fourth has to do with contradictions between the spatial scale of the state and the spatial scale of capitalism, which is most acutely captured in the notion of a globalized economy with territorially restricted states. So these are four ways in which you get contradictory functionality, and each of them involve contestations, institution building, and institution failures in different ways. The first of these is the contradiction between legitimation and accumulation. This argument was most systematically developed in the 1970s by a Marxist economist named James O'Connor in a very influential book of the period called The Fiscal Crisis of the State. It's interesting, that's a book from the 1970s. The title would be relevant to a book in the present period, The Fiscal Crisis of the State. Very influential book. He argued that there are two kinds of distinct state intervention. So broadly, we can distinguish these two kinds of interventions needed for stable capitalism. One are interventions which serve to legitimate the system to the masses. These are interventions which make capitalism acceptable to people. And the other are interventions which are favorable for the conditions of accumulation. Interventions which are good for profits and for capitalist firms. Sometimes these functions work smoothly together. Right? So sometimes it happens that the policies which are good for capitalism also produce legitimation. And that's particularly true when the policies which are good for capitalism create rapid growth and therefore plentiful jobs and tight labor markets. So there are moments in which they work together. And indeed, one can argue that the best legitimation policies of the state are precisely those that create a prosperous capitalism. So they can work together, but they may not work together. And indeed, they may deeply contradict each other. The contradictions between social security and budget deficits. So large budget deficits can create problems of interest rates, which affect the availability of credit for capital accumulation. But the social security benefits help legitimate capitalism by making it more tolerable for people to be and reduce risks in their planning for their own retirements. The basic idea of this contradiction that O'Connor laid out was this: capitalism imposes considerable risks and deprivations in the lives of ordinary people. That's a fact of capitalism and markets. The state provides a way of softening these risks and therefore reducing the social conflict that these risks sometimes generate. The state does this by providing certain kinds of benefits. We refer to these as the social safety net, but it includes a broader array of benefits than just the kind of minimal fallback. In some capitalist societies, these are very expansive. There's universal health care, there are stable pensions, there are nursing home facilities, long-term care facilities that are also provided for the state. In others, like the United States, these tend to be much more restrictive, but still massively more now than they were 100 years ago. So while, you know, we think of the United States as having a pretty fragmented and incomplete welfare state, it is still a massive welfare state compared to anything that existed anywhere in 1900. So we do have a massive social wage. The social wage is the term that's used for all of these benefits that are provided collectively rather than just through individual market power. Once a benefit becomes firmly established, it is viewed as a right, as an entitlement, thus that constant term, entitlement reform. Right? Entitlement reform. And therefore, there tends to be a ratchet-like quality. You get a legitimation boost by increasing these entitlements. But people are very reluctant to attack them because you get a legitimation deficit if you reduce them. Spending thus has a sticky downwards quality. And it's notable in the US, in spite of the frothing at the mouth of the Tea Party and the kind of hysteria of Republicans about the budget deficits, it's still very little cuts. You know, even in the most precarious of these programs, Medicaid, you know, medical help for the poor, and food stamps. I mean, these are precarious programs. They're programs targeted for the poor, means-tested programs for the poor. As the saying goes, programs for the poor are poor programs. But even these have not been drastically cut in general. It's still the case under Scott Walker's Wisconsin, that Badger Care provides health care for most desperately poor people, as opposed to that just getting wiped out. So these are sticky downward programs. They're harder to unravel once they've been established. And this, therefore, generates a potential contradiction between legitimation and accumulation. Now, arguably, the protests in Wisconsin in the fall, you know, can be roughly described in this way. There were two different ways of thinking about how to balance the needs of accumulation, which would reduce taxation and make more resources available to capital, and the needs of legitimation, which would provide these securities. So that's one of the contradictions, therefore, in accumulation and in functionality. So this is why this is contradictory functionality, is that the stability of capitalism is not simply reducible to the stability of accumulation. The stability of a capitalism needs both the stability of accumulation and the stability of legitimation. When those work smoothly, no problem. You know, when they work smoothly together, which they do sometimes, then the state can do both. But when they come into conflict, it's just not so easy to unravel the legitimation costs and reduce the social wage in order to boost the accumulation function. And that becomes, therefore, this contradictory and contested functionality. On Wednesday, we will talk especially about the next item. I think the next one, autonomy and subordination, is the in some ways the most important. This is the Frankenstein problem. And the Frankenstein problem, I think, is basically what's in play in American politics today. That is, I think the paranoid fantasies of the Tea Party and the ideologies of the right are that we are in the midst of a Frankenstein state. And the progressive forces believe that this is, that we're not, that the state apparatus and its functions provide necessary conditions for social reproduction. So we'll talk about the Frankenstein problem, which is the second one on the list, on Wednesday.
Professors, the bold.